focus has shifted, and for obvious reasons, onto the proceedings in court at the moment. But Meg has been almost forgotten in all of it. The media photos aren't really of her. There's not a lot about what actually happened in the beginning. So it's very difficult to kind of keep her memory alive in all of this, which is why the whole trial is still going on in the first place, so that we can find the truth and we can find justice for her. And that's why we're here today, really, just to be present and remember Meredith in the city that she loves.
I think we remember her as sort of, as we said before, up until the point she went. I think our dad's spoken before, it's almost as if she's gone away on an extended break and we haven't seen her come back as yet. You know, she's obviously got a lot of friends, a lot of photographs of her, which is nice. I think it's just the same way that you know anyone would really remember any sort of good friend or sister. Stephanie was probably close to her than I, as much as obviously both girls and similar age. But yeah, you know, I think we perhaps feel it the most when we sort of meet up for things like her birthday and Christmas, which are obviously sort of a couple of months off now, and her absence is huge, really.
Hey, lovely listeners, and welcome to Crime Analyst. This week, I have a very special interview to share with you, an interview with Amanda Knox. Now, if you follow me on social media, you'll know I tweeted Amanda following her tweets about the movie Stillwater, and I asked whether she'd talk with me. She responded, literally straight away, and within days, I was interviewing her. Now, full disclosure, I've analysed the murder of Meredith Kircher on Real Crime Profile, and we deconstructed the case across 10 episodes, and it's number 37 onwards, and so you may wish to listen to those episodes first. And so, without further ado, here's my interview with Amanda Knox. Hi, Amanda, and welcome to Crime Analyst, and I would love it if you please introduce yourself for my listeners.
Hello, my name is Amanda Knox. I am a writer and podcaster. I co-host a podcast called Labyrinths with my husband, Christopher.
Which I have been listening to most your episodes, and I am really excited to be talking to you. I have followed you for a long time, and the case that you were and became associated with. And in fact, on my other podcast, Real Crime Profile, we did deep dive the Meredith Kircher case.
I've heard great things about you, and I'm excited to chat. I know that you covered the case, and one of the things that I was struck by, at the very least, when I listened to at least the first episode, was that you didn't actually mention my name for a long time, and I thought that was a very, very appropriate. So, thank you for doing that.
We actually did 10 episodes on it, and I interviewed someone that we both know and share in common, former FBI agent Steve Moore,
who an amazing person
is an amazing person. I know you know him much better than I do. I've worked with him professionally a number of times, and we did two fantastic interviews with him where he really gave us a much deeper understanding of what was going on in Italy. But perhaps you can say how you know him, and I'll give a little bit more context and ask you a couple of questions.
Yeah, that's great. And I actually interviewed him for my podcast as well, a little bit discussing how he ended up coming into my life in this really interesting way, which is that basically his wife became aware of my case, and he had sort of casually absorbed the headlines and was like, oh, yeah, this, you know, guilty person in Italy. And his wife, Michelle, was like, I don't know, hun. I think she's innocent. And he was like, fine, I'll prove you wrong. And then he started looking into the facts of the case and was like, oh my gosh, you're right. And I have to do something about it. And of course, him being the heroic figure that he is, he lived up to his word and, came in, swooped in to support my family as they were, you know, trying desperately to prove my innocence. It wasn't just a matter of, demonstrating that I wasn't not guilty. I was definitely a proving my innocence kind of situation. And he was ultimately there the day I got out of prison, in the car chase out of the, you know, prison setting, and helping me get safely back home to America. So he's been on this wild ride alongside me and my family, being an incredible support person who came out of the woodwork and didn't have to care, but he did. So great guy.
And listeners, please do listen to that interview, because there are some funny moments in it, which are kind of unexpected.
Yeah. But
he has got a good sense of humor. You know, being former law enforcement myself, you do have sort of at times a dark sense of humor. And there are these moments when you're, you know, being chased that Steve characterized very well in terms of that narrative. And I mean, for me, I've done a number of things with Steve now, and I didn't realize that how he came to your story. And we asked him to describe, you know, Michelle and what went on. And full disclosure, I was of the same opinion. I was in the UK at the time working at New Scotland Yard. I remember the framing of the case in the media, by a particular journalist, and, you know, the sex game gone wrong, the ritualistic killing. But I remember seeing those headlines, and I remember thinking, but what I'm hearing about actually what happened sounds very different, and it not being congruent. So that was my first kind of question mark. But I was really intrigued when I think it was Jim who said, well, let's look at Meredith's case, or that he initially mentioned your name. And I said, well, it's actually Meredith's case. She's a British young student. And the more I dug into it, the more I was like, this is just incredible. How is this even possible? It's like peeling an onion. We just found more and more just incredible and fantastical things that had become fact and that were being reported in the media as fact. And wow, it tells you the power of the media, for one, you know, that who has the microphone, who's telling the stories, which is why I'm really excited to speak to you, because I think women should tell our own stories. They're so nuanced. And to be honest, I get fed up with men exploiting women's stories and women's trauma. You know, it's really important we reframe and we reshape. So I'm really pleased to speak with you. And definitely to the listeners, listen to Real Crime Profile's forensic deconstruction of the case, of Meredith's case, because you said something interesting to me as well, Amanda, that we didn't talk about you. We talked about Meredith all the way through until really it came to Steve, who... started to tell us something, you know, very different behind the scenes. He was in Italy. He could tell us things that were happening that weren't in the public domain or weren't in the newspapers. But this is your life. This is, you know, when does it end? When I was watching what you were writing on Twitter, your incredible thread about Stillwater. Mm. And, you know, perhaps we'll get on to that. But I'm so glad that you had some good people around helping you, because it was 8 years of your life and 4 years in prison. Can you give, you know, my listeners some idea of what that felt like, as being a young student, didn't speak the language, suddenly thrown into this situation where you're just trying to help because it's a traumatic situation. And as things unfolded, it just got worse and worse.
Yeah, I mean, from the moment that I came home that morning and found my house in disarray and ultimately discovered the crime scene when the police arrived, everything from that moment on felt very, very surreal and very, very overwhelming. Suddenly, you know, my life was no longer in my hands. And I felt like, even just in that moment, I, you know, had no idea that anyone would ever come to suspect me and this whole case would take over my life in such a huge way. Even just hearing, like, there's a body in that room, there's and people crying out Meredith, and like that, even just that experience of being a young person abroad, your friend is dead, like, you, the existential crisis of that is tremendous. Like, it was such a shock to my system to realize how vulnerable I was in the world, and to have that, like, brutally, brutally demonstrated right there out of nowhere. Like, it was the beginning of a long realization of how much we all are vulnerable to each other and how much we all depend on each other, and how much that dependence on each other can be either bolstered by storytelling or totally just shredded apart based upon storytelling. So, you know, to this day, I'm still haunted by the idea that that could have been me in that room. Like that, if it hadn't been for the fact that I had just started dating this young guy and I was hanging out at his place, like that could have been me. And the fact that, you know, one of the things that the Stillwater thread that I was talking about, this Stillwater film that took a sort of false and pernicious idea about my involvement and sexualizing the case and all of that as the premise for this fictionalized story. One thing that it really, you know, this has been something I've tried to explain in many different ways over time. But like Hollywood and in general media, I think also has a problem with victims' stories, like things that happen to people that are not in their control, that they didn't have agency over. What happened to Meredith? What happened to me? These are all cases where storytellers don't really know what to do with it because victims aren't responsible for the things that happen to them. And the only time that storytellers really want to give victims agency is to blame them, is to say, oh, well, you did something and therefore it is somehow your fault that this bad thing happened to you. And I've been trying to wrap my mind around how this case just got out of control and how that was, it was just such a grave injustice for everyone all around. You know, Meredith was a victim of Rudy Gaudet being out of control, and her family and my family and myself are a victim of the media and the Italian justice system being out of control in response. So, I don't know, it's a broad topic, and going through the experience of having my identity stolen, being told that I am a monster, I am a femme fatale, I am a murderer, and hearing that, like having the prosecutor stand there in court and like put words into my mouth, literal words into my mouth, like this is what Amanda probably said to Meredith as she was stabbing her. Like, this is insane. It was so surreal. And I kept thinking the entire time, everyone notices how insane this is, right? Like, I'm not the only one sitting here in the courtroom recognizing that this is crazy. And because of that, I kept thinking, there's no way. There's just no way that this is happening. I almost felt like I was above myself a lot of the time watching this happen to me. And then when it came down to that verdict, I thought, there's no way. I'm going home today. Like, this is when it finally comes to an end. And when it didn't, and I realized that I was in a much longer road ahead of me that had no guarantees, I mean, it's surreal. Anyway, that was a long and very winding response to your question. I'm sorry.
No, don't be sorry. There are some really important things that you said there. One is about you going home and finding your roommate brutally killed. I mean, that is hugely traumatic in the knowledge that, yes, that could have been you. I don't think people think about that.
No, you know,
the vulnerability, that could have been you.
Yeah. And one thing that I like to point out to people, because, you know, a lot of people think, oh, do you hate prosecutors and law enforcement now and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no. Before I was a victim of the criminal justice system, I was an indirect victim of a terrible, terrible crime. And I think that law enforcement and a criminal justice system is crucial to society. So it's not that I'm saying that the criminal justice system is entirely corrupt or that all law enforcement and prosecutors are corrupt. Absolutely not. These are all important tools that we need in society because we are dealing with... I talk about Rudy Gaudet in another episode of my podcast and how he, first of all, is the forgotten killer. And I'm so grateful that Steve Moore worked on that project to really try to redirect attention to where it belongs, to the person who actually committed the act. And I've thought about this person, Rudy Gaudet, and how, you know, I mean, you've covered the case, so you know about his background and how he kind of had a Peter Pan existence and was in and out of people's homes, didn't seem to have a lot of like sure guidance in his life, and then went on this burglary spree, and that just culminated in this brutal rape and murder. And part of me, who has, you know, lived alongside people who are guilty of horrible crimes, because that's what happens when you live in prison. You live alongside people who are guilty of horrible crimes. And also having come out and immersed myself in the innocence community and in like the restorative justice community, like a part of me really wants to try to humanize even Rudy Gaday, and to say, young man, made a lot of terrible decisions and horrible mistakes, and that came at the cost of not just Meredith's life, but other people's lives as well. How do I feel about that person getting out after 13 years in prison? Does, you know, how much does he deserve a second chance? And I always sort of feel like everyone deserves a second chance. What hasn't really happened in his situation is full accountability for his actions. And that's the thing that sort of haunts me about the case, is that similar sense of non-closure that Meredith's family feels, how they're like, well, the verdict that was ultimately handed down doesn't satisfy what was the truth of what happened in this case. And was the person who was ultimately responsible found fully responsible? Like, all of that sort of remains up in the air because of decisions that people in positions of power exercised mistakenly. And it's, again, I'm rambling.
No, but important Sorry. Things being said. Hey, lovely. I know life can be such a juggling act, particularly if you're working all the hours and you have little ones. For me, if I apply my eyeliner, my brilliant eye brightener, my mascara and red lipstick, I feel ready to face anything. They're my staples and make me feel better about facing the world. And no, it's not superficial. Well, not in my book. It's the little things that matter. And if you could do with a makeup refresh, Thrive Cosmetics has a full line of makeup to refresh your everyday look. With clean, skin-loving ingredients, their foolproof products make it easy for any skill level to apply. Also, Thrive Cosmetics' Bigger Than Beauty mission is amazing. For every product purchased, Thrive Cosmetics donates products and funds to help communities thrive. I love that Thrive Cosmetics supports domestic violence victims, breast cancer survivors, and women who are homeless. One of my go-tos is the Brilliant Eye Brightener. You can use it as a highlighter or an eyeshadow. It's a highlighter-eyeshadow combo that makes your eye look effortless, and it's super easy to apply. There are 16 buildable shades to choose from. I apply a light shade, and I recommend Stella. Not just because it was Gillian Anderson's character in that amazing show, The Fall, but because if you apply it to the inner corner of your eyes, it gives you a glow and opens your eyes, making them pop. You can use a metallic shade all over your eyelid and blend it with your finger for an easy smoky eye. I recommend Muna. It looks amazing. So treat yourself and help women thrive. Refresh your everyday look with Thrive Cosmetics, luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 10% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/crimeanalyst. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/crimeanalyst for 10% off your first order.
I mean, yes, Steve wrote the book, The Forgotten Killer, and let's not forget that Rudy Gaday was arrested. He was charged and he was convicted before your trial even happened. And the Absolutely. Silence around that was deafening. That told me something. God. 100%. And I think you sound so well balanced with such humility. I don't know if I could be like that, Amanda, I have to say, because I'm still angry on your behalf because the Kirchers family, yes, they didn't get the true account of what went on. They still feel there's been an injustice for you and for your family. So many lives have been, I'm not going to say ruined, because I know you're on an incredible pathway, but it took you off potentially the path that you were on and took you to a very different place. But Rudy Gaday's DNA was at the crime scene in multiple sites.
It was in Meredith's vaginal cavity. It was in, there were fingerprints in blood, footprints in blood. There was feces left in the toilet. He admitted to being there. You couldn't get more of a, what I would say, simplistic crime.
Yeah.
And they knew those things, but Mignini focused on you. That's unforgivable. And he focused on you because of a kiss and because of him watching you and him saying that he knew a killer when he saw one and because of his own misogyny and gender bias. And that is unforgivable. He was in a public office there to serve, to put a dangerous person into prison because he was a risk to other people. And what he did was create a circus, and he misdirected, misfired, and he cost you 8 years of your life. And that, as a professional, talking of another professional, that's unforgivable. That's corruption of the highest order, actually. And he was already on a charge for malfeasance in a public office for doing things that were corrupt prior to what happened to Meredith. And that's why people should really read the book, The Forgotten Killer, and should listen to Real Crime Profile, because actually it's indisputable, Rudy Guede, it was a single killer. And it's indisputable to me as a former law enforcement. And unfortunately, you were, some might say, wrong time, wrong place, but you came under the lens of a man who made these ridiculous statements that he knew a killer when he saw one for very worrying reasons. If I don't know if you listened to Steve Moore give us some more background on Mignini, and that Rudy Guede was stealing laptops. The laptops from attorneys associated with the case against Mignini.
Yeah, it's very, very sketchy. And one of the things that I've noticed, the whole background of Rudy Guede being caught and released again and again and again after burglarizing places, and Mignini's background of misconduct in office. It's interesting. I always, a lot of people say, like, oh man, if I were in your shoes, I would be so angry. And I find that the people who say that the most are people who work in law enforcement. Because, like, first of all, I think to work in law enforcement, you have to have like a really super sharp, you know, perspective about justice. And it's got to be something that you're deeply passionate about. And furthermore, you know how to do this job. Like, you know how to do it right. You know how to do it wrong. And so you're looking at this person who is closer to you in terms of like your career, and you can see him making the mistakes, but also following through with those mistakes in a really corrupt way. And, you know, maybe that just means that I was never bent for law enforcement, because I feel like I'm trying in my own sort of journey of trying to wrap my mind around why this happened to me. I feel like I've taken a more sort of philosophical bent, in the sense that, like, okay, what do I know that we all have in common? We all have cognitive biases in common. We all make mistakes, and we all retroactively try to justify our mistakes to ourselves, because a lot of times we think we're doing things for the best reasons and with the best intentions, even when we're doing them for selfish reasons and for selfish intentions. We think that we're doing them because that's what we're entitled to do, or that's the best thing that we can do. And we don't realize that we don't have the best motivations in our decision making and our ability to analyze the facts. So I guess my approach to all of this has been to approach it with a sense of humility, try not to automatically vilify anyone, because I know what that feels like, and to think, how, if I give everyone in this situation the benefit of the doubt, can I really hate anyone, given what has happened to me? And I don't know, it just doesn't come naturally to me to like hate anyone, even after everything. I pity people, and I have a deep hope and yearning for there to be reconciliation. One of the things that I really, you know, hope for is to reconcile with the Kircher family. And that's not something that it can easily be done from my position. A lot of people ask me, you know, have you ever, you know, talked to the Kircher family? And it's like, well, hold on a moment. Let's consider what that feels like from the Kircher family's standpoint. Meredith's family has been very vocal about how they thought that I was involved in Meredith's death. So how are they going to feel if I just out of the blue give them a phone call or send them a letter? Like, it can be deeply traumatizing. So knowing that, recognizing that, I've opted to give them space as opposed to force a sort of reconciliation on them, even though I know it could be so, so healing, not just for me, but for them too. It's an interesting conundrum to find myself in. And in the meantime, I'm doing my best to try to do restorative justice in my own life as best as I can. And that includes like being as fair and compassionate and open-minded as possible, even towards the people who did this to me, and did this to my family, which is hard because everyone in my family has been impacted.
Yeah, your mom and your dad and everyone around you, and even what you're
saying,
yeah, and even what you're saying now just shows tremendous compassion and empathy and humility. I know when you were younger at school, Steve shared the story that they created a compassion prize because of your empathy levels. And that gave me a marker immediately about who you were, not who the media were framing you to be. You know, the whole Foxy Noxy nonsense. And I do feel strongly about women being framed because I think women get it far worse, actually. And I always said about Meredith's case and Nicole Brown Simpson that everyone wanted O.J. Simpson to be innocent, but everyone wanted you to be guilty. And that makes me very angry in the way women get framed or footnoted, even in their own murders, actually. It's a bigger picture, isn't it? And you were caught up in that. But, you know, one word about Rudy Grady, he's never taken responsibility for what he did. He was happy for you to be blamed and for you to lose many years of your life, potentially to get a life imprisonment sentence. He was happy for all of that to happen. So I understand you have huge levels of compassion and empathy, and you don't want to hold on to anger because it does corrode your own soul. Yeah. But actually, the fact that he doesn't take responsibility, the fact he's out now, the fact that he got a short sentence and, you know, 16 years, which is what he got on appeal, reduced to 13, and then he's out in December. Does that fit the crime of what he did? No, it doesn't, in my view. And it's because a beautiful young woman who was your friend was brutally murdered and raped. And yet he wasn't charged with rape and murder. He was charged with sexual assault and conspiracy to commit murder. And even that tells a story to me.
Yeah, good morning, George. The murder of Meredith Kircher and the trial of her roommate, Amanda Knox, gripped the world for months. Since then, only one person has remained in jail for that crime. Until now.
This morning, the man convicted in the assault and rape of British exchange student Meredith Kircher is free. An Italian judge ruling Rudy Guede can complete the rest of his sentence with community service. Guede was the only person still serving a sentence in Kircher's death. A fast-track process resulted in less jail time, but he continues to maintain his innocence, now saying justice has not been done. Kircher's roommate Amanda Knox and her boyfriend Raffaello Sollecito were also found guilty, but their convictions were overturned.
I continue to this day to be shocked that he is the forgotten killer, the one who was quietly tucked away, convicted of a lesser crime, and does not have to live with the burden of being forever associated with Meredith's death.
With press interest in the case at fever pitch, prosecutors accuse Knox and Sollecito of killing Kircher with Guede's help. Although only Guede's DNA was found on the murder scene, other DNA was found, but this evidence was later thrown out.
I do know that many, many, many people have suffered a great deal because of what he did.
Knox and Sollecito were both convicted before being exonerated in 2011.
Una copiosità di sangue.
But Guede remained in prison for the next 6 years. He received a partial release in order to attend school in 2017, but his sentence is set to end in 2022. Knox, now 33 and an advocate for criminal justice reform, says the burden of his crime falls on her.
I do wish that he had been fully held accountable for what he did and that he acknowledged what he did.
Now, since his partial release, Guede has been working at a library in central Italy. He's also been volunteering for a Catholic charity. His lawyer says this is a milestone for the 34-year-old, but this must be a very painful time yet again for the Kircher family.
No, I agree. And like, I'm going to be honest, like, I am angry. Like, I do
you
feel a
be.
Lot of anger. And it's hard because I understand how much anger can corrode you. And I think that especially because I've just sat there in that prison cell waiting and waiting and waiting and realizing that if there were many emotions that I was feeling and I could see myself going down that path of bitterness if I really gave in to the anger. I saw a lot of people around me in the prison environment who had done that very thing. And I really, really did not want that to become who I was. I was almost afraid that like my wrongful conviction was going to destroy me, not because, you know, my freedom had been taken away, but because it was going to make me an angry, bitter person. And I really, really, really fought hard against that. And what it meant was that when I got out of prison, I had this shocking realization first of all, as I was going through prison, it's not that I didn't feel the anger. Like, I felt the anger, and the way that I dealt with it was I totally numbed myself. I just got numb, and my anger sort of became this simmering sadness that just I sort of floated on throughout the entire time that I was there. I was just sad. And then when I got home and I was thinking, I got out in 2011 after 4 years in prison. I thought, okay, finally I can go back to the life that I should have been living in the first place. I can go back to being an anonymous student and go back to school. Well, first of all, I realized that that life doesn't exist for me anymore because it's this international scandal and everyone now associates my name with a brutal murder that I had nothing to do with. And I am forever seen through the lens of this murder. Nothing that I will ever do and nobody that I will ever meet will not have that in mind. That sort of triggered a moment where I finally felt like I finally started feeling the anger again. And I can't tell you the number of times that I had to just like go for a run to just like grapple with that feeling that really had no outlet, right? Like, how to process that was tremendously difficult.
I can't imagine, because it feels like it's never ending in terms of other people shaping. I've heard you talk a lot about the idea of who you are and who mm-hmm. they think you are.
Yeah.
It's a lot to grapple with. And let me just say that you have met someone who genuinely has an understanding that you were innocent. And actually, even in Italian law, your case went to the appeal court and the Supreme Court, and you were found innocent. That's a very important thing to say, actually, because the Italian legal system is slightly different. You're either guilty or you're found innocent. And it's quite unusual to have a case, from my understanding, Italian colleagues and others, and from talking to Steve, but to have a case where you were found in both courts, appeal and Supreme, to be innocent. So even when the media frame you as convicted murderer, or there's been a lot of headlines, even when Rudy Guede came out, that I corrected on Twitter, that, you know, talked about you and your flatmate being murdered, no mention of Meredith, her name, no mention of him. Yeah. And it just must be incredibly frustrating. For me, I always correct those headlines in all cases because I have a lens around women. But the word choice is important, isn't it?
Yeah, no, the word choice is fundamental because ultimately what people think of when they think of my name is not innocent girl abroad. That's too complicated. What they think of is one word and one word only, murder. They think of murder. That's what the case ultimately comes down to. Meredith Kircher was murdered by Rudy Guede, and the name that they associate with that event is Amanda Knox. And so Amanda Knox murder is the thing that goes into people's minds and is just inextricably linked. And that is a tremendous burden for me to carry. That is not even mine to carry. Like, that's what's insane. And what's horrible is, like, first of all, it's horrible that Meredith Kircher should have murder next to her name, too. Like, that's not fair. And that's one of the incredible injustices of Meredith Kircher's story, is she doesn't even get to, like, respond to that. Like, that's why murder is so horrible, is because, you know, even after a rape, like, there is the potential at the very least for that person to reframe their story in some way. And murder is just the one that you can't. There's nothing you can do. And it's deeply sad. It's deeply sad. And there's, I'm sorry.
It's all right. Take a moment.
Yeah, it's. And I keep thinking, you know, again, like, I was so close to this person. Not like close, like I knew her forever, just like literally right there next to her. And I can't believe that just out of nowhere like that. It's. I mean, how do you deal with that? You're law enforcement. You look at these cases all the time. I don't know if I could do that, because the consequences of it are just so devastating. Like, how, and like, I love that you try to reframe these stories, because, like, so often it's the women are the victims in these cases, and they don't have a voice, and they don't get to have a say about how people talk about them in the aftermath. And like, what do you do with that? How do you give back voice to people who aren't here anymore?
It has been my life's work, and it, unfortunately, there are so many cases that need reframing, and they need a female expert to do that. And most of the headlines are written by men. I mean, 94% of crime writers are men. Most of the things that we women experience, and I mean in terms of violence against women and girls, most men were never experienced. So they don't have that empathy and that compassion. And there is a gender bias. So I do spend a lot of my time talking to people about how, you know, we see shows like Dirty John, for example, which, you know, is a huge case of many women being victimized by a man who is a psychopath. And even when I interviewed Christopher Goffard, who broke the case with the LA Times, I told him, you know, the case is about coercive control, stalking, and a psychopath, a very dangerous man. He said, I don't understand coercive control. What's that? And I explained it to him, where men, you know, normally it's men will entrap, dominate, abuse, exploit. And really, it's about domination of a female partner. And it's very dangerous, and it correlates with femicide. And he said, wow, Laura, I've never heard that term, and I wish I'd met you before the podcast went out, because I would have told Deborah's story differently. And those moments of light bulbs that, you know I'm doing my job, I'm doing the work of helping people understand experiences that they will never have, but to have compassion and empathy. And it's not just, well, Deborah was silly, she made some silly decisions, which is what a lot of people thought. It was about how John took her autonomy, her agency, and her self-esteem, and eroded those qualities drip, drip, drip over time, to the point she lost her voice. And I think oftentimes, you know, yes, with murder victims like Meredith, most people don't know her name. They don't even know what happened to her. People still say to me, to this day, just this morning, someone said the Amanda Knox case. And I get really annoyed about that, because I'm like, it's nothing to do with Amanda. Amanda was wrongfully convicted. It was a miscarriage of justice of extraordinary proportions. There is no doubt in my mind that she is innocent. We know he was guilty. He was arrested, charged, convicted. And people always say, really?
There are so many benefits of microdosing, and all sorts of people are microdosing to feel healthier and perform better. Microdose gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. And who doesn't want that in life? I love how helpful these gummies are. For me, half a microdose gummy on the weekend helps me stay centered and fresh as I work out and get everything done on my weekend to-do list. One gummy, about 30 minutes before I go to bed, helps me relax at night and really be present in the moment, instead of worrying about things from that day or thinking about what's coming tomorrow. Get 30% off your first order plus free shipping today at microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST. It's available nationwide. That's microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST for 30% off and free shipping. Microdose.com, promo code CRIMEANALYST.
Yeah, I know. Oh my gosh. The most annoying question that I get from people, even like, you know, very, very like supportive people, people who like, you know, hear about me offhand and like send me a message on Twitter or something is, who do you think really did it? And it's like, oh my God, like this is what is wrong with the world right now. A case could make it around the world for 10 years and the actual person who committed the crime, who was arrested like within weeks of the crime happening, is not, nobody knows about him.
Yeah, no one knows his name. It's insane. And it is completely insane, but that tells a story. You know, why rush a case? Why rush him through the criminal justice system? For me, that's a red flag, which means that I would ask more questions. Why was it your face in all the newspapers? In fact, Nick Pisa, the Daily Mail journalist, started the whole Foxy Noxy BS. And he was asked that question. And he said, well, Amanda Knox was far more interesting. Rudy Guede wasn't interesting. Yeah. But the problem is, it shouldn't be about who's interesting and selling more newspapers through headlines at women's expense and at the expense of your freedom. There were so many moments where I had a visceral reaction to him when he was asked about fact-checking, for example, and he said it wasn't his job to fact-check and that he didn't have time. But it was his job to fact-check. It was his job to fact-check that the prosecutor giving him the information was factually accurate. Mm-hmm. It matters. And then when you place it in the wider context, well, it's the Daily Mail, Nick Pisa wanting all the headlines to sell newspapers. Well, it became about him, his entitlement, his desire to see his name published. And it came at huge cost to you. People in the UK were reading those newspapers. And yes, you should fact check and there should be due diligence. That's really important. And particularly how women are framed and treated as second-class citizens, that people can get away with it. And it, you know, people might say, well, it's people in the criminal justice system, but this was men, actually. McNeely was driving this ship, and he was giving that information to Nick Pisa purposefully for him to put it in the newspapers and to frame the case in a certain way. And that's why no one really knows about Rudy Guede. And Jim Clementi and I actually took apart his interviews. And actually, there were very concerning things that we heard in the interviews of levels of psychopathy. You know, and I did hear you say about giving people a second chance. But actually, some people are very dangerous. And therefore, with psychopaths, they cheat the system. They're very manipulative. They have no empathy. They have no compassion. They don't take responsibility. And there's lots of things that you can tick off indirectly with him, and I worry about the risk to other women, and I have to do that. That's my job. I worry about what did he learn, really, other than to cheat and finagle his way through the system, whereas you're showing compassion and humility and saying, I want that reconciliation with the Kirchers. She was my friend. I doubt very much he's having those conversations even in his head or with God or with anybody, and that tells me a story too. But he was the one that got the lighter sentence. And in fact, the prosecutors were pushing even harder for you to get a life sentence, even with him in prison. That's just unacceptable. And when you understand the physical evidence, I remember watching the crime scene video, you know, and I'm seeing what they're doing at the crime scene. It's bloody. They're passing around evidence. They're not changing gloves. They're not using tweezers. They're walking from room to room with the same booties on. Just things that, wow, you know, the scene was contaminated, but the things that are being said in the courtroom, that here's the receipt, Amanda cleaned up with bleach, here it is. And I'm seeing the crime scene footage and I see there's no sign of cleanup. Lies. I mean, that's not just about a law enforcement professional being angry or agitated. It's about the truth and the facts and the evidence being put in a case to stop a miscarriage of justice so that the right people go to prison who should be there because they're a danger and a risk, and you're taking up a cell that you shouldn't be, and the lifelong implications of that. I'm getting all overexcited again.
No, I mean, I hear you. And it's true. Everything that you're saying is absolutely true. And the one thing I wanted to sort of touch upon that has been a big sort of eye-opening experience for me is, you know, you talk about how the police fed the tabloid journalists, especially Nick Pisa, all of this basically bullshit information to try to tell this story that implicated a young woman in the death of another young woman because it was just such a compelling story. It sold so many newspapers. And I think that that goes to show that, you know, I recently have been thinking a lot about storytelling and journalism resembles Hollywood a lot more than it really should, because there's something that's, you know, there's a difference between entertainment and public interest. And right now there has been a confusion about that. The way that the media industry works is it is now an entertainment product. And that is often at the disservice of the truth. And so when someone like Nick Pisa is saying, well, the reason we decided to tell a story about Amanda Knox is because it's more interesting, he's saying that it doesn't matter what the truth is. The truth doesn't matter. What matters is what's going to get me on the front page of that newspaper. And that's really scary if you think about it, because we all have different expectations of what the media is supposed to do and also what prosecutors are supposed to do. They're not supposed to overlook or make up evidence because it's compelling. They're supposed to just care about the truth. And so even one could argue that, like, the criminal justice system, or at least in certain courtrooms, it resembles Hollywood more than it should. And that's scary to think of.
It is. And I remember him saying, well, I was getting headline after headline after headline. Why would I possibly fact check? You know, this story had everything. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not about creating a story. And then when I compare it to other cases with the Me Too movement and work with journalists of how hard it is to get those cases where there's serial rape, there's, you know, lots of different victims, but to get those cases into court and to get them onto the newspapers when you've got factual, you think of Ronan Farrow and Catch and Kill and just all the steps that were taken to kill that story. And yet there's a journalist with you putting you front and center, ritualistic killing, sex game gone wrong, turning it into something that was so different that when I understood the crime scene, you know, and for me, it was a burglary, actually, that evolved into something else. That's what everything tells me when I look at it and deconstruct it. But it was made into something so different, and the motive was completely skewed, and it allowed somebody who actually had been burglarizing and escalating in behavior to be allowed to be out and free for far longer. And you were very much under the lens. And it should not be like that our criminal justice system is paying more attention to the headlines, and even in the courtroom where evidence is disregarded or a narrative is shaped that is so, well, you could drive a truck through it. You know, that's the concerning thing. And you think about costs to you and to Raffaele Sollecito. I hope I said his name right.
You actually said it very right. A lot of people screw it up, so well done.
Good, because I know you're fluent in Italian now as well. But the cost to both of you, to your families, but to the criminal justice system too, it costs a huge amount of money to put these cases through the system, the appeals and everything else. And for then the Kircher family, who are reliant on it having interpretation of what's going on, and they're being force-fed information, that really is unforgivable, and the whole narrative that continues for you. So we've sort of stepped into still water, which, you know, the way you write is incredible, actually. The thread that you wrote, and I recommend everybody read it. I think it was on July 29th, and it's pinned to your Twitter feed, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I also did a more, like, I sort of fleshed it out more. If you're not a Twitter user, you could also find a more fleshed out essay-like version in The Atlantic. But yeah, that sort of touching upon, first of all, that problem of when certain names are associated with events, not because there's an actual that it's appropriate, but it's just because that's how the narrative was spun. So calling Meredith Kircher's murder the sordid Amanda Knox saga is deeply inappropriate and irresponsible. But also this issue of when storytellers take, you know, real life events and throw a very thin veneer of fiction on top of it and then claim that they're allowed to tell whatever version of that story they want to tell, and they're not accountable to the people who are directly impacted by that representation. And that's an ongoing problem. You know, when Tom McCarthy made that film, he compared it to what he did with Spotlight, which is when he used real people's names and real people's identities. And he says that that's not what he did in the Stillwater piece. But my name was used to promote that film. And what happened to Meredith and what happened to me are very, very obviously portrayed in that film. Like it is. Her story. It is my story. And he decided to portray it in the most superficial, false, pernicious way that emphasized the scandal that people are aware of about my case in the zeitgeist, but which doesn't represent reality. And that ultimately has impacts not just on me, but on everyone who is involved. And to claim that shouldn't matter to me, or that I should have no feelings about that, or that I should watch the film first before I come to any sort of conclusion about it. It's like, honey, I don't need to watch the film to know that you've misappropriated this case because you've used my name in the promotion of your film. You've already crossed the line there. And I hope that starts a conversation about how, you know, especially men in positions of power in storytelling who have a lot of money and profit to make feel entitled to the stories of people who have been through really, really traumatic experiences, and how that stealing of a victim's authorship is an ongoing aspect of the trauma against them.
Absolutely. I couldn't nod any harder. when you're about to fall off the balls that I'm sitting on at the moment. But, it's so right to point out the entitlement, you know, to feel that they're entitled, or that McCarthy's entitled to say that it's based on, inspired by the Amanda Knox saga. And even to say he couldn't help but imagine how it would feel to be in your shoes. Well, you know what? You pick up the phone, you email, and you ask, right? That's how I understand other people's experience, by talking to them. Mm. But that didn't happen, right, in this situation?
No, not at all. Not at all. No. And, you know, as much as I feel that, I can empathize with storytellers insofar as I understand that all fiction is inspired by reality to a certain extent, but the fact that there are so many real stories that are recreated in a really recognizable way in Hollywood, and the storytellers responsible for those representations are never accountable to the people that they're representing, that is what is really troublesome to me. Because it's like, I get that you had a moment where you were like, gosh, it must be crazy to be in her shoes, but you've never been in my shoes, and you've never been in my father's shoes. It's interesting that, you know, Tom McCarthy's impulse was to empathize with not really my plight, but my father's plight. That's why the story that he decided to tell was from the male perspective. And I was essentially my most traumatic experience of my life was a plot point for the inciting incident of this male story.
The male POV is far more important, of course, that everyone would relate to far more than the female POV. I mean, that again is, it tells a story, doesn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, which isn't to say that I don't think my dad's experience of going through this and supporting me is not valuable and important, and not, you know, doesn't have its own, you know, merits in its own right. Because I do think that the families of people who have people who go through the criminal justice system, either as victims or as the accused or whatever they are, their experiences are also a valuable story to tell. But as much empathy work as he did towards the male figures in this story, McCarthy, it is undoubtedly true, he didn't do that same empathy work for me. And the question is why? Why didn't that happen? And if he had the best intentions, what does it mean that someone with the best intentions can still overlook the humanity of a woman victim in this case?
Yes, and if you want the real essence of the story, then you would expect that to have happened, because he talks about reaching out to lots of different people. And there was no reach out to you and saying, well, you should watch the film first, it sort of flies in the face and is just a complete brush off. So I'm glad that you've written and spoken out about it. And I really wanted to talk to you about it so that we can reframe the narrative at the time where Scarlett Johansson is also going through, you know, what I would call sexism, gender bias, and the callous disregard because she's holding people to account on her contract, which a man would do and no one would blink
an eye. Yeah, exactly. I agree. Yeah, the idea that a woman standing up with herself is somehow now this like negative person, that's insane. And I agree. That's something that is a woman's burden. Like we're not allowed to be litigious. We're not allowed to assert ourselves. We're not allowed to defend ourselves. And so, you know, even just the choice of standing up to this was, I did have a thought about it. Like, are they just going to say, oh, yep, here's another bitchy woman coming in to bitch about stuff? Like, it's an ongoing problem. It's because of this black and white narrative about women and how we're supposed to be in the service of male stories. I think we're the inciting incidents of and the motivation for a lot of male, you know, action, and we're not allowed to take action ourselves and have our own motivations and our own agency.
Yes, well, we're taught from a very young age to be polite, putting other people's needs above our own and not to say anything. And if we do, then we have an opinion. We're opinionated, where a man is just able to say what they want to say, but we're opinionated, we're tricky, we're difficult, we're all of these things that have negative connotations. And the more I can help advocate, amplify women's voices, the better, because we need to hear more women's voices. And I'm glad I could shape some of the conversation today. And any way I can help you going forward, you know, please do let me know as an advocate. I know you're a writer and a podcaster and you do incredible things, signposting and helping people as well in terms of those where there have been miscarriages of justice. And just to say, one of the longest running and very high profile serial cases in the UK that I've been covering on Crime Analyst, and unpicking what really went on, which was distorted by the media, what really happened versus what was put in the media, but also uncovering four huge miscarriages of justice where the wrong people went to prison. It's blown my mind, actually, Amanda, because that's not normally how I come to cases, but it's really opened my eyes. So anything I can do to help or to amplify, to reframe, to correct the narrative, that's what I do on Crime Analyst as well. I follow the facts, the evidence. And yes, there are points where you debate and you discuss, and that's all part of arriving at an opinion or having different hypotheses before it becomes a theory. And that's really what Crime Analyst is about. And I just think, you know, in Meredith's case, unfortunately, a theory was arrived at very early on by a prosecutor who had been charged with malfeasance in a public office because of the Il Mostro di Firenze case, the Monster of Florence case, which, again, my listeners should look that up. There is a whole backstory. And I do believe he was trying to make his name on your case. And he was also trying to shape what was going on with him being charged. So there's a whole backstory before Meredith is even killed. And unfortunately, you were victimized as well. And I do see you as a victim in this. And of course, Meredith's name, we must always mention and talk about, but anything I can do to help. And it's been wonderful, and I mean that, talking with you, being very generous with your time and very honest. And I hope we can have further conversations, and, you know, I'd love to continue the conversation with you.
Oh yeah, that'd be fantastic. I really, really enjoyed talking to you. I'm glad we connected, and thank you so much for reaching out and for caring so much. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. And I appreciate that too, from one pregnant woman to another, because that's something we share in common, which, you know, I'm so happy for you and so excited for your next steps and your next adventure. And I hope it's full of happiness, laughter and joy, because you deserve that.
Yes, I am very excited for parenthood. It is this long journey that I've been on. So I'm very happy. And I was just thinking about this the other day, how, you know, I don't know if you've listened to the latest episodes of my podcast Labyrinths, but I was discussing the infertility crisis and how I had my own sort of infertility experience and how it's such a shockingly common thing that we never hear about. And it's this existential crisis. But also I was thinking, you know, that wasn't my actual first infertility crisis. My first infertility crisis was being handed a 26-year guilty verdict and basically being told, you will never be able to have a family. And that was one of the things that I had to think about as I was continuing on my trials and hoping to prove my innocence. So, and is this your first?
It is. First one,
oh,
yes.
Oh, congratulations. All right. Good luck.
Thank you. Yes, not long now. So I will keep you posted.
Thanks. All right.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Amanda. Take care. Keep in touch, please. And look after yourself.
You too.
And thank Christopher for doing the mic and all the logistics as well.
Will do. Thank you so much.
All right. Yep. Take care.
We'll do it immediately. Yep.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, I hope that gave you further insight and food for thought. It certainly did me, particularly around that last point that Amanda said about the sentence of 26 years for a woman. When a wrongful conviction takes place, particularly for a woman, it can take away the choice of motherhood. Just another thing to think about. Well, next week, I'll be talking with award-winning author and journalist Jess Hill. Now, Jess is Australian and she wrote the book See What You Made Me Do. It's available in the US and also in the UK too. And she's just completed a docu-series of the same title. So you may wish to check those out before you listen to my episodes, but I guarantee that you won't want to miss this interview. For now, however, I want to end thinking about Meredith Kircher and also about her family. Hashtag, her name was Meredith Kircher. And so until next time, be curious, ask questions, and always trust your instincts.
And here's my final 2 cents before the episode wraps. The first is a huge thank you to all of you, my lovely listeners and crime analysts, for tuning in every week. The second is an ask. If you like what I do, please take 2 minutes to leave a 5-star review on whichever platform you listen to me on. It really helps others find me and helps with the ratings. So thank you, thank you. Crime Analyst is written, produced and hosted by me, Laura Richards. Sound engineering by Tim Hansen at Half Ogre Studios. Cover art and graphics by Chris Raybottom at Syndicate, and music by Kilrude.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.